From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On this week's episode of On Story, we'll hear from two stand-up comedians with strong backgrounds in television writing. Sketch comedy master and the Kids in the Hall co-founder Kevin MacDonald and The Simpsons staff writer and Stand Against Evil creator Dana Gould will discuss the ins and outs of writing different forms of comedy across varied mediums.
You do write what you know. I mean, people say, like, when is the show going to run out of ideas? Well, as long as people live their life, you're going to have ideas. And I can look at every episode that I wrote and tell you what was going on in my life at that time, because it reflects it inevitably.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Kevin MacDonald is a comedian, actor, and writer who founded legendary Canadian sketch troupe, The Kids in the Hall, with his friend Dave Foley. The Kids in the Hall, eponymous television series, ran for 5 seasons, from 1989 until 1995, and was produced by Saturday Night Live founder Lorne Michaels. I spoke with MacDonald about the history of the group and the process of writing sketch comedy at the 2019 Moon Tower Comedy Festival in Austin, Texas. Clips of The Kids in the Hall and The Kids in the Hall Brain Candy, courtesy of Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Since we talk a lot about story here, I think it would be a good thing to start with your origin story and how you ended up actually putting this sketch group together.
Right before I met Dave Foley, I remember being 18 and not sure what I was going to do. I had just been kicked out of theater school because I knew I was funny, but I knew I wasn't stand-up comedy funny, which I've been proving all week here doing stand-up. So I just started to write sketches. I thought I would write sketches, and then I would send them to people. I didn't know who. And SCTV at that point was my favorite sketch show. I mean, overall, it's Monty Python, but SCTV was happening then. So I wrote parody. And I remember in the same afternoon, I wrote 2 sketches that are really similar. But I wrote a parody of Psycho, in the movie Psycho. It was called Psychosomatic. And it was just me in the shower screaming. That was funny. And then the other sketch I wrote, which is sort of the same kind of idea, it was a parody of The Odd Couple called The Odd Schizophrenic, where I was both messy and tidy. And my mother always said, Kevin, I know you want to be an actor, but I don't think that's your talent. I think it's writing. She always said that. She would say things like this, my mother of truth. She would say, I don't think you're good looking enough to be an actor. She would say, she's dead! She paid for it. Oh, yeah. And then I met Dave Foley.
But what were you doing when you met Dave Foley?
Well, I was kicked out of acting for after 3 months. And so then I went into Second City workshops. I was 19 now. For the first year, everybody was over 30. They weren't that funny, in my pompous opinion. And there were 2 teenagers, and I thought we were the only ones who were funny. And the other teenager was Mike Myers. But he was like special funny. He was like a wunderkind. Is that the word? He was special. I was like a lumpy potato of potential. He was as good as he ever became. He was good already at 17. He was like 2 years younger than me. And you just knew that he was special. And he, by the end of the year, he got hired for Second City. And then the very first workshop without Mike Myers, another teenager came in. He almost looked a bit like him if Mike Myers wore glasses, and it was Dave Foley. Dave, I didn't know him, and Alan Gutman was the workshop teacher, and he, just by coincidence, he paired us in groups of twos, and Dave and I were the two, and we had to do the mirror exercise, where you mirror each other's movements, and we hadn't even talked to each other, but all of a sudden, I guess it's the word chemistry. It seems like a hokey story, but we started doing funny movements, and then we started going down to the ground, and then we mirrored each other in the fetal position, and then we started crawling outside of the Second City onto the street. Lombard Street. And I remember Alan Gutman ran out and he went to the door and like through the screen door, you could hear him, come back, get back here, get back. And we were laughing our heads off. So we were the only funny ones in the workshop, but we had like a chemistry kind of thing. And so I went to Dave after, I didn't know his name. And I went to the class, I went to him and I said, do you want to join my comedy troupe? I didn't have a comedy troupe. And he said, yes. And then I phoned my friend Luciano Casmieri, and we have to start a troupe. And there's a guy, he's another Mike Myers. We can't let this one go. And that was the original Kitson Hall, Luciano Casmieri, Dave Foley, and Kevin McDonald.
So then, I mean, you're, as you've pointed out, incredibly young. And your troupe then somehow in the next few years gets the attention of Lorne Michaels and a TV show. And you were all really young when you started the show, too. So can you talk a little bit about how that process worked?
Yeah, I think so. I think in those days, especially in Toronto, the only troupe was Second City. I think our intent was to be different. We were also like friends first, and we just happened to be funny. But we were funny in a different way. Dave Foley, when he got drunk, he would say, "We're like the Sex Pistols of comedy." And that sounded like a bit pretentious. But we were always... I don't mean this as a compliment, because this works both ways, but it turns out that we're original thinkers. And so sometimes I work and sometimes it doesn't. We auditioned for Second City several times until later when Lorne Michaels discovered us, but there were three left in Toronto that they hired us just because of that. They would not hire us. They were very honest. They said, "You're too weird." But we're Canadians, so we thought they were just being nice. We thought they meant, "You're not good enough." But as it turns out, we were weird. The kind of troupe that we wanted to be back then, now there's a million troupes. They all have TV shows, and they're all great for some reason. But back then, Monty Python were sort of the... I always say this. Monty Python are the Beatles of sketch comedy. The Kids in the Hall are the Duran Duran of sketch comedy. Get their greatest hits. But the only blueprint for sketch comedy was Monty Python. So I think we didn't go around saying this a lot. Maybe Dave and I did a bit. But we always thought we'd get discovered. We'd have a TV show. It would run 5 years. Then we would do a movie. It would be a gigantic hit. And then we would do another movie every 4 or 5 years, like Monty Python. And the way we do have a less successful like blueprint, we do that. We do get together every 4 or 5 years, but now because of Brain Candy bombing, it's like it's usually for a tour. Or, you know, our nickname for Brain Candy is cost $8 million, gross $3 million. It wasn't the biggest hit, but we like it. We're proud of it.
So talk about that process of working with this new group of folks you're working with. I mean, and I know you added on people or switched out people, whatever, along the way.
Yeah, people would quit and new people would join.
But how that process worked for you as a writer, I mean, how you sort of found your voice as a sketch writer.
I wrote before I knew the Kitson Hall, but as soon as it was Dave Foley, Bruce McCullough, Mark McKinney, and Crazy Scott Thompson, I was so intimidated by them as writers. For the first year, I sort of, when we were just a stage troupe, before the TV show, I sort of just stopped writing. It was too intimidating. The way that Mike Myers had intimidated me, they're all like writing geniuses. And how we wrote in those days was we'd come up with ideas, and then we would write it through improv. So I got my saying through other people's ideas, like writing, like coming up with lines and stuff through improv, but I was too afraid to tell my ideas. Like I had to write, because then when we got the TV show, and I was starting to write in the last like year that we were a stage troupe, we didn't write through improv anymore. They introduced us to this 80s thing called computers, and so I was in a cubicle and I could do whatever I want all day, and then the nervous part was bringing it into the read-through. But you get used to that after a while, even though we're all very mean people giving notes, still you get used to it. And I did sort of, I went back to the way I was that week that I wrote Psychosomatic and the Odd Schizophrenic, and I wrote all the time, and I sort of got a lot of sketches in, so Dave Foley was right.
You have now this troupe that you're all, I'm sure, learning to work with each other and how to use each other best, and you're performing all of this material for the public, and then you what?
It became the five of us, myself, Dave Foley, Bruce McCullough, Mark McKinney, Scott Thompson. The other really good ones got better jobs, so it was us five losers that were left. And we almost quit working together. And then Mark McKinney said, why don't we try one more time? It was simple as that. There was a club on Queen Street West in Toronto called the Rivoli. They were famous for gothic rock bands and waiters and waitresses who never smiled. And for some reason, we got that club. So every Monday night from the summer of 84 to the summer of 85, we did like a show of completely new sketches. We sort of pretended that we had a TV show. New sketches. And at first, nobody came. It was like for the first 3 months, it was like always 17 people. And when we played women, we didn't want to do it insultingly. So my girlfriend at the time, Tiffany Lacey, you remember Tiffany Lacey? Yeah. she had this big red sweater. All the audience, because it was the same audience every week, they knew who was ever wearing the red sweater was playing the woman in the scene. Because we just did it like men. And then the audience gradually got bigger. And I remember in January of 1985, there was a giant blizzard in Toronto, a giant blizzard. Streetcars broke down, and we thought, oh, no one's going to come tonight. Well, let's practice, let's rehearse anyway and be ready. And it was the first time that we had to turn people away, and there was a lineup around the block. And I remember it was a good show. What did we do for the first time? Oh, we did a scene called If Elvis Was My Landlord, where Bruce, he's having a party, and then the landlord said, stop making so much noise! And Bruce kicks them out, and then he turns to the audience and he says, it wouldn't be that way if Elvis was my landlord.
If Elvis were my landlord, we'd say stuff in the halls like, 42 tenants, can't be wrong. Gee, I could go to his house anytime and borrow a cup of sideburns. If Elvis were the man.
How you doing? Well, I just wanted to tell you to top your garbage bags before you put them down the chute. Makes my job that much easier. Thank you very much.
And we were sort of like finding our voice at the same time as the audience was finding us. And then from then on to the summer of 85, we sold out every week. And then Mark McKinney said another very simple thing. He said, you know, we got to go to the next level somehow. We do new sketches every week. There's so many good sketches. Why don't we rent a theater out, the Tarragon Theater, and we'll do a best of the Kids in the Hall for a week. And then things like took off from there. This was the summer of 85. Lorne Michaels had quit Saturday Night Live 5 years previously. And it was right at the beginning of that summer that he'd announced that he was coming back to Saturday Night Live. So he was sending talent scouts to comedy cities all over North America. Toronto was one of them, because that's where you got Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner, and that's where he's from. And then on our last show, the Sunday afternoon matinee, Yvonne Fasson, who was the Canadian guy who was the president of late night at NBC, and he was like only 30, and then he became the president of CBC a few years later. Lauren sent him to see us because of the good review. Actually, it was Yvonne Fasson's idea, and he saw the whole show. And the next morning, I got a lot of excited phone calls, and then we had a conference call with Lauren Michaels. And to make the story longer, he didn't want to spend five plane tickets on us auditioning. So he sent Franken and Davis.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. We'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with the Kids in the Hall founder, Kevin MacDonald. When we left off, MacDonald was discussing the history of the group's television series, which was produced by SNL creator Lorne Michaels, and how his mother convinced him to pursue writing.
We did a whole show. We did an hour and a half show, The Rivoli. We booked The Rivoli, and which Franken and Davis were the only ones in the audience. And it was an audition, and that was the one week of ugliness with the Kids in the Hall, because we all fought to get more scenes because it was our audition. And we did it, and then we had dinner with Franken Davis. I just remember Al Franken saying, "You guys are good, but what are we going to do with five of you?" And then they hired the two most experienced ones, and at that time, they were the best writers. They deserved it. Mark McKinney and Bruce McCullough, they wrote for Saturday Night Live for the next year in what we now call the Anthony Michael Hall year. Then a year later, our agent, Pam Thomas, convinced Lorne Michaels to come and see us. We ran another show at the Factory Lab Theater. And, it was a horrible night. I'm almost finished, I swear to God. It was a bad night. We were just off. And then Lorne Michaels came back, and we thought we'd blown it because it was an audition. And Dave made a joke. I forget the funny part, but the joke was how badly we did. And then Lorne Michaels, he sounds really smart. Even when he doesn't say something smart, he sounds really smart. And he says, no, you know, you learn more about an act on a bad night than a good night. And that sounded great. And then he signed us to do a TV show, and it took a couple years for him to convince people.
You were still really young when you all ended up on TV, and it's funny watching those Kids in the Hall episodes now, especially that first season. And it seemed like, especially that first season, that you were writing a lot of material that was really playing into that. And one scene I'm going to particularly point out was one of the first sketches, the Reg sketch.
Oh, yes. That was a sketch, yes. I always say with that sketch, if anyone would ever ask us to put a sketch in a time capsule, nobody will. I don't think there are such things as time capsules. I would pick that sketch because it sort of defines us in a way.
But it was something that sort of, it felt like a scene out of Stand By Me, you know, except and it turns very dark, obviously, which gets me into the question. It's like you guys seem to have this utter innocence in your performance, and I would, especially in that first season, but almost every episode has a very dark turn to it, so, or sketch. So I wanted you to talk a bit about, you know, how that happened with your development of the material.
Yeah, I think we're just dark naturally. We all had horrible childhoods, like many comedians, but we seem to embrace it more. And Bruce McCullough, he was the first one to write dark stuff, and he seemed to open the door for us to think, oh, dark stuff is good. The thing with dark comedy, though, I think if you go around saying, what dark sketch are we going to write? I think you're screwed. If you go for darkness, I think you've got to write what you write. Like, we love Carol Burnett, and we love South Park, so that wasn't invented yet. But whatever else dark comedy was around back then. And you've got to write what you write naturally. And later people would tell us, that was really dark. How Scott's character died in the sketch of AIDS, but even though he's dead, he keeps saying cancer. That's really dark. And we said, oh, yeah, I guess you can see it that way.
One of your episodes in season one, you also did a sketch that was writing a sketch. Writing
yes.
A comedy sketch.
Yes.
And it was what is required, and it was a premise, conflict, a resolution, and then a mug to the audience. But from your real perspective here, like from your storytelling perspective, what is the sort of genetic makeup of a great sketch?
Well, to me, I did go to Humber for 3 months to study theater because I didn't know what to do first. And the one thing I remember was the very first thing that I don't know if he's called a dean in Canada, but I'll call him the dean of the acting program. The very first class, 9 a.m., the very first one, he had a blackboard, and Jerry Smith was his name, and he wrote, in our business, it's all about this. And he wrote the word idea, and then he circled it 1,000 times, and that really excited me. And then later in a sketch troupe, that's what it's all about, the idea. And when we get an idea, sometimes you get an idea and you don't know and you have to work on it, but sometimes you get an idea and you get that chill. And when you write a sketch, there's two amazing sensations. The second best sensation is when the sketch goes well that you've worked so hard on, but that's the second best. The best is the first time you think of that idea. The very first time that I thought of the idea, What if Buddy Holly, before he died, he was a real mean guy to everybody on the plane and deserved to die? I remember like getting that like that thrill. Oh, that's a good idea. And every time I get an idea, and I'm wrong all the time, I always think, this is my hit single. This is my Stairway to Heaven. I get really excited and I write it down. But the second sensation that happens after the first sensation is always disappointing. Once you write it on paper, it is always flat. Because in your head, it's the most exciting thing in the world. You can do anything with it. You can go anywhere with it. Then when you write it down, it's like death. It's always disappointing. And then you learn craftsmanship, especially if you have a TV show for 5 years, and you learn how to pump as much life into it as you can to get back to the first time you had that exciting idea. I don't know if that answers your question, but I enjoyed listening to myself.
There are a number of sketches, particularly ones that you performed in, that are some of my favorites, and Jerry and Jerry being one of them.
Sizzlers?
The Sizzlers. King of Empty Promises is another one, and then Sir Simon and Hecuba. They're classic. But one of the things I love about the show, too, is that there is such a commitment to, like, once a sketch is on, it seems like the voice is really clear and the tone is really clear, so that you're watching something that doesn't really go awry. Can you talk about, like, how something would become a recurring one and how you knew that that was really a successful one? And at the germ of the idea, you know, what were you thinking to, were you looking at it as a long-term sketch?
First of all, I want to go back to Alan Gutman, the workshop teacher. He said another thing that sort of influenced the kids in the hall. Dave and I were in the class, and he said, and I think he was talking to Dave and I in a way. He always encouraged us. He said, when you find a comedy partner, the best way to come up with ideas is spritzing. And we didn't know what spritzing meant. And spritzing is like vaudevillian speak for just hanging out with somebody and coming up with ideas. For example, Dave Scott and I were walking down the street when we were just a stage troupe way before the TV show, and Scott told a horrible, dark story that I can't tell on television about his life, and he said, I guess I have demons. And then Dave told an even darker story that I really can't tell on television, and he said, I guess I have demons. And they looked at me, because I'm like a light jello pudding to them, and they said, they're sarcastically, like, you have demons, huh, Kevin? And I said, yes, polite demons that would open a door for a lady carrying too many parcels, but demons nonetheless. And then they laughed, and then we started writing up Simon and Hecubus. So spritzing is very important. We had this mantra about running characters. And we were like, again, from Queen Street West, Greenwich Village, New York, we were hip and cool. So it was a bit pretentious, but it gave sort of part of the voice of the show that we now know as the voice of the kids in the hall. And our rule was that running character sketches could only go in if they were as good as any other sketch that week.
Well, but so where did King of Empty Promises come from? What was that?
King of Empty Promises, for those of you who don't know which one that is, but may know it, it's where I promise to do things and they say, will you do it? And I go, will do. And then when I don't do them, I go, you said you were going to do that. I go, slip my mind.
So did you bring my videos?
Slip my mind.
Should I even ask about the Godfather?
Don't bother.
Man, this is starting to cost me money, you know. I mean, sure, the video store is going to be on my ass, and rightly so, because when you rent a video, you enter into a sacred trust.
I'll tell you what. Let's have dinner tonight. Pesto's at 8. I'll bring the video. I'll bring the Godfather. You know the Paul Simon album you've been wanting me to tape?
Yes.
I'll tape it and bring that, too. And dinner's on me.
You don't have to bother with all that. Just bring me the video.
No, I want to. I'm just sick about the whole thing.
By the third season, we had hired guys who were in the troupe before to write with us. Norm Hiscock, comedy genius, was there. I guess that was the second season. I'm sorry, Norm. Norm wrote with everybody. So for me to say Norm was my comedy writing partner is unfair because he wrote with everybody. But I would wait when he was writing with Bruce so he could work with me because we wrote really well together, as Dave and I did too. And then we would get in the office early, so we wrote a lot of mornings together. And I came in the office one day and I said, Norm, I don't have any ideas. What are we going to write today? And Norm said, Kevin, why don't we write about that horrible thing that you do to people? What horrible thing? So, what you always promised, like Chris Cooper, our editor, you said you were going to make a tape of that Paul Simon album for him, and you never do. And it's true. My only defense is that I'm a child of an alcoholic, and I want to please people, so I promise them things, and I mean it at the time, but an hour later I forget, and I don't care anymore. And I'm still like that!
So you've now written these things, you've worked them, you've rehearsed them with each other, right? How much, when you actually get into the performance mode and you're getting ready to do the show, or doing the show, how much ends up being improv added to that?
That was the weird thing, because when we were a stage troupe, we were writing through improv, so there were no scripts written down. There were a lot of ad-libs. A lot of things that became famous jokes from the scenes were ad-libbed during live performances. So that's our Second City training. That's sort of what you learn to do, and it's exciting, and it's sort of the fun part of the job. Dave Foley, in 1985, now that I'm being talkative, we hated improv, but we loved doing it, but there's something we hated about it. I remember him saying, improv is the new mime, meaning that we didn't like it. But we love it. It's love hate.
You were a mime, weren't you? You were a mime as Jerry.
Was it? I don't remember. That rings a bell. Here's a boring story how we thought of that sketch. We were doing a Kathy sketch, the two Kathys, and the Bruce's Kathy was dreaming that she was a beauty queen. We were all playing women in the beauty contest, and the makeup put on wigs on Dave and I, and then Scott screamed, "My makeup is horrible!" And then there was an emergency, and all the women had to leave for an hour to calm Scott down. So Dave and I were in a dress and wigs, but no makeup, and we started acting like two clearly insane people.
What's going on out there?
Nothing, hon. Just an old army buddies dropped by. You go back to sleep, dear. Look, you've got to keep your voice down.
Look, Jerry!
Look, my name isn't Jerry. It's Lister. And your name isn't Jerry either. It's Jean-Pierre.
Don't be silly, Jerry. That's a French name.
Yes. And before you became chemically unbalanced, you were a respected French mime instructor.
Jerry, you are clearly insane.
No, I am clearly not insane. You are the clearly insane one.
Jerry, I'm not clearly insane. I'm your sister. I'm your sister.
And and we laughed our heads off when we wrote down notes. And by the time they were ready to film us, we had the sketch written. Spritzing, Alan Gutman, 1981.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Brain Candy.
Brain Candy was very hard to write. The problem was that Lorne Michaels is amazing, and he's the reason we have a career, and he's the one that got Paramount to sign us to a movie deal before we had a movie idea. And that's sort of the hardest way to write a movie. And I really liked the idea we came up with, but it was hard to come up with an idea. Because he had just produced Wayne's World, and so Paramount signed him a contract for like 10 years of movies. We had to come up, it took us a year to write the movie. First, it took us a few months to come up with the idea. We had a few ideas, but then we came up with Brain Candy. Brain Candy was called The Drug, and I still think that's a better title. It was The Drug. It was Mark McKinney's idea, and it just seemed like a great movie idea. Because when we were a stage troupe, we wrote through improv, and then when we were a TV troupe, we wrote in groups of one, two, and three in our little happy cubicles. But now, the five of us plus Norm Hiscock, so the six of us, had to write together in this awful boardroom of death. But writing-wise, we finished the first two acts. If you do that Sid Fields thing and break a movie into three acts, we wrote the first two acts really easily. And then we were stuck on the third act. And then I was going to my first psychiatrist because my wife, Tiffany Lacey, had left me. So I went once a week in the mornings, and then I go with the kids in the hall. And then she said this to me, whatever we were talking about. She said, "Well, you know, Kevin," I guess I was complaining that I wasn't happy. And she was saying, "You know, Kevin, the true nature of happiness is knowing that you can't be happy all the time." And I said, "Oh, that's good." And then I was walking to the office, "That's what the movie's about! That's what the movie's about!" And I ran in and I told them, and they got excited. And once we figured out what the movie was about, Act 3 got written really easily. And even Mark's character, the Serbian cab driver, he even says that in the movie.
"So what does this whole story mean? The only way to be happy is to know you won't be happy every single day. La 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 la. It sounds better in the original Croatian."
It also sounds like one of the elements to writing great sketch comedy, though, is knowing the people you're working with so very well. And
chemistry and friendship.
Almost being married to them, sort of.
Yeah. Dave and I have this chemistry thing where we, on stage and in real life, and I've never liked this with, I'm not like this with anyone. I have chemistry with the other kids in the hall, but Dave, like it happened that day when we both knew we were going to go down on the floor and crawl outside, but we can sort of read each other's minds. Because there's this thing in improv that used to be called blocking. I don't know what the kids call it nowadays, where you're supposed to say yes and. You're not ever supposed to say no, because that sort of stops the momentum of the scene. But if you're with us, like someone that you have close chemistry with, Dave will say something, and I know that if I say yes, I'll be blocking his idea. I know where he's going, and I know he wants me to say no, because he has an idea. I just know that, and he knows that with me. And that's, you either have it or you don't. It's like falling in love. It's like that kind of chemistry, falling in love. You either have it or you don't. Though it can develop, if you work with someone for a long time, it can develop a little bit, but Dave and I had it right away. I love him so much.
Next up, another conversation recorded at the Moon Tower Comedy Festival in Austin, Texas. Dana Gould is a stand-up comedian who began his professional comedy career at 17. Gould has appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman, Jimmy Kimmel Live, Conan, and Real Time with Bill Maher. In addition to writing and performing stand-up, Gould was a staff writer on The Simpsons and created the IFC horror comedy Stand Against Evil. I spoke with Gould about the differences between comedy writing for stand-up and writing for television.
I'm going to start out, I guess, asking how you realized, how you got into the side of comedy writing for television in particular, because you started out really as a comedian, right?
Yeah, I started as a comedian and was living in, and had been, done it for several years, and had made my way from Massachusetts and Boston, where I started out and where I'm from. I lived in San Francisco for a while and ended up down in Los Angeles. And I was a hot young talent at the height of the era where they would just give you development deals to come up with, you know, because Seinfeld was on and was a big hit. And so, like, you're the next Seinfeld. There's $35,000. And, you know, I had a bunch of pilots. Dana, Nice Try, the appropriately named Nice Try, created by Linwood Boomer, who went on to do Malcolm in the Middle. I've had my hand in more failed pilots than an Air Force proctologist. Not long after that, George Meyer, who was a friend of mine, was writer on The Simpsons, said, I heard you were thinking about doing some writing stuff. Would you like to come into The Simpsons for like a day a week and just kind of punch up jokes? Because he knew me as a stand-up. And I was like, yeah. And which is really like, if you ever see the movie Let It Be, when Billy Preston comes into jam with the Beatles, he's like, okay, I'll just sit here and play with you guys. That's what it's like your first day at The Simpsons. Like, all right, here we go. And I worked there a day a week for a while, just kind of punching up jokes. And it took, you know, several months before I figured out the algorithm of the show. And then this story infuriates people because it was so unintentional. One day, Mike Scully, who was running the show, came in the morning and he said, you know, I think your contract is up. And I was like, oh, God. And I was like clearing out my stuff. Like, I'm so sorry. I'll put my coffee back. And and he said, do you want to just come every day? And I said, yeah. And he's like, and he said, I'll never forget it. He said, all right, I'll call your agent. And then he went, sucker. And that was it. I was there for like 7 years.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. We'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with stand-up comedian and The Simpsons staff writer and Stand Against Evil creator, Dana Gould. Before the break, Gould was discussing the writing process behind America's longest-running animated series and how his real-life experiences are fused into everything he writes. Clips of The Simpsons, courtesy of 20th Century Fox.
So can you talk about how that process went for you? You're now a new full writer in there, and you're going to pitch your show to the crew. How did you break that?
It's awful. You have to understand, most of the people in that room, not all of them, but a lot of them are guys that went to Harvard. They wrote on the Harvard Lampoon. Then they worked on Letterman or SNL. And then they came out and worked on The Simpsons. And that was like a very standard trajectory for people. And I was a dropout of the University of Massachusetts who was a stand-up comedian. So to them, I was a carny. Like, you know, it's like, they all went to Harvard and I ran a tilt-a-whirl. And I had been a very, you know, I had a lot of success. When I decided to become a writer, I'd been on Seinfeld, I'd been in the cast of a sitcom, I'd been on Letterman, I had had a good career. And then, you know, I was in my 30s, I was like, I got married, I bought a house, and I'm going to be a grown-up, and I'm going to have a job with a parking, I had a car and an office and a place where I park, and felt like a grown-up. And then you go in that room, and you really have to just, like, please leave your ego in the car, because they don't care. And it was a good lesson that it didn't matter. So you're pitching a story, and the great thing about The Simpsons, as I said, the show has certain algorithms, and the way the stories are designed, at least when I was there, was it's three acts, and this is something that I have taken. You know, it's like the first act is a freestanding story that has nothing to do with the story. The first act is like an opening sketch. The story starts at the end of the first act, the beginning of the second act. You do your story in the second act, and in the third act, you turn it as hard as you can without breaking it. And that came from my experience in the room, came from George Meyer, and who would say, and you know, surprise being the most facile tool in the comedian's toolbox. And so you do write what you know. I mean, people say, like, when is the show going to run out of ideas? Well, as long as people live their life, you're going to have ideas. And I can look at every episode that I wrote and tell you what was going on in my life at that time, because it reflects it inevitably. My dad was a bartender and a hunter. So my first episode was about bartending and hunting. I was like, I thought it'd be great if Homer ran a bar. The way my dad ran a bar. So I was like, well, maybe Mo goes back to bartending school so he can go to Mo's. You write down stuff. You have a couple of days where you come up with a general idea. You come up with an idea. Homer runs a bar. This happens. And then you sit with the other writers and you just sort of airball ideas that can go into the episode. I had gone to the W Hotel in New York and I was in the men's room, but I didn't realize I was in the men's room because the W Hotel in New York is an orgasm of style over function. And I went into the men's room, and then I was just in this room with bare walls that had a waterfall against one wall. And I was looking for the door into the bathroom, and then somebody else came in, started pissing against the waterfall, and then a guy who had just walked out of the wall that had a toilet behind it. I was like, it was just why you would disguise a bathroom when you're inside a bathroom. We're all in there for the same reasons. And so we thought, well, it'd be funny if Mo did that to the bar, if Mo completely renovated Mo's in that regard.
Wow, check out the new Mo's.
Wow, it looks like an alien headquarters. Couldn't you just see aliens running out of there? Couldn't you? Hey, waiter!
Looks like a long wait to get in.
Not for friends of Moe's.
Oi, oi! Is your name on the list?
Don't you know who I am?
It's okay, Cecil. They're VIPs.
Cecil is a girl's name.
And so he turned Moe's into M. And so I pitched it, and it evolved. Like we had the general idea of Homer taking over the bar. That's funny. Then we'll go to the bartending school with Mo. And then it was like, well, where do you want to take it? Where do you want to take it? And they had an original ending that they threw away. And we came up, I forget what it was, but we came up, we were just talking about other ideas, and we came up with a hunting thing. So that's how we ended up with them going hunting. That particular episode is, I think it's not my favorite that I wrote, but I think it's the funniest that I wrote. The opening segment was just Bart digging a hole, which came from George Meyer, who was just like, what, you know, how do you want to start it? Because again, you look, I think it came from SNL. We just start with a freestanding sketch. So it's like, well, and George is just like, I like when kids dig a hole. Like maybe just Bart can just dig a hole. And then so I said, yeah, and then he could be a Chinese spy satellite and start wondering what he's doing. And that was the first, as a rare example of a joke that I pitched at the outset of the show that ended up on the show, which never happens because it's a creative meat grinder. It's just like everything just gets chewed up just by the nature of the process. But the joke was you go up into this Chinese satellite and they're looking at Bart digging a hole.
Those inscrutable Americans, what are they up to now?
I will stop them. I am strong. I am the great humongous.
We all know you're the great humongous.
Well, I'm just saying.
Oh, you're always just saying.
So which is the favorite episode that you wrote?
The favorite episode I wrote, again, as I said, you can see where I am in my life by how I, by what I'm writing, was called Goo Goo Gaipan. And it was when they went to China to adopt a baby for Selma.
I'd like you all to meet someone. Introducing Ling Bouvier.
Selma, she's beautiful.
This is Homer, your daddy. Without him, I wouldn't have you.
Oh, she likes my eyes. Ow.
Homer, I do appreciate what you did. How'd you like a little time with Miss October?
I would, but Marge would kill me. I mean, oh, right. Oh, ow, ow.
Homer? Of all the sneaky, dishonest things you've ever done, playing Selma's husband was by far the sweetest.
I had just come back from adopting a baby in China and thought, well, there's some interesting stuff here. And that, unlike Homer the Mo, that story flows very organically. It's a better story, I think. It's a really good, complete story. And obviously, I had an emotional connection to it. And the baby, Ling Bouvier, who I believe is still on the show occasionally, is my daughter, Lulu. And she's designed on her baby picture. And so one day, my daughter Lulu, who's now in her teens, was watching The Simpsons, and she came on. And I went, oh, honey, that's you. And she just goes, yeah. I go, no, honey, that's you. That was the episode I wrote about you. That's your... She's designed on your baby picture. That's you. And she just goes, yeah, I like Bob's Burgers.
What was going on when Lisa became president?
Oh, that was sort of an assignment. They wanted to do a musical episode. And I thought it would be funny to track Evita with Lisa becoming the president of the student council. And also thought it'd be funny to track Lisa's hubris through a story. This is the origin of that story. The great white whale of my time at The Simpsons was I wanted to do an episode where Lisa became goth and just track that whole thing. I don't know why I couldn't. I honestly think because the people that were running the show at the time I was pitching it, it was quite literally, they equated goth with Columbine, which is like apples and trucks, and they just didn't want to go there, and I was really frustrated by it. But they said, but maybe we'll do the opposite. Maybe she'll become like the student body president. And then the Evita thing came in. Well, yeah, I will do that, but she's got to be super flawed. Then I had to watch Evita like six times. But the good thing is I learned how to like write the songs.
Well, that was actually my next question. I mean, like, yeah. How did that process work? Because writing a song and you know, I mean, like how close to it was your experience of like writing your stand-up or writing the...
The Simpsons is very much a team effort. If you think that your words are precious and that you have a singular voice that needs to be heard, I can tell you where you should not work. It's very much, we serve the show, and you know, you're here for the show. No one's bigger than the show. And the success speaks for itself. But that was really fun. That had one of my favorite jokes that I wrote on the show on it, which was, Lisa Simpson is out of control. She's like some kind of female Eleanor Roosevelt. I think that was also the one that had Old Man Yells at Cloud, which was another one of my... It's one of the memes I've contributed to our culture. But it was interesting. That really felt like an assignment, that was a job. I really like that. It's different from stand-up, which is so personal and so connected to who you are, to also like take an assignment and you feel like, yeah, I'm a craftsman. There are times doing that with a feature right now. It's like they came to me with an idea because of Stand Against Evil, which was a horror comedy. So in that world, people are like, oh, well, it's a horror movie, but we want it to be kind of funny. We'll see if you can do it. And it took like 2 months to figure out, well, here's how you could do this so that they both work. I like the puzzle-solving aspect of it a lot.
So getting to Stand Against Evil, you mentioned earlier your dad with the Mo episode.
Yeah.
And now your dad has an influence on you and your storytelling because you end up with Stand Against Evil.
Yeah, my dad is the largest mountain in my psychic landscape. We were roommates in my childhood. There wasn't a parenting relationship, really. I have 4 older brothers and a younger sister. I came from a big family. I was in the middle. I was small. I didn't go along with everybody else. It's kind of on my own little journey. And he couldn't deal, you know, he's an older generation. He's 88 now. And he wasn't the generation of talk to your kids and figure out where they're from. Like, it was like, are you into the thing I'm into? No. All right, then later. And so I had a very contentious relationship with him. But then as I got older, you know, I got to understand him more, and we have a great relationship. And the premise of Stand Against Evil, which was a show I did on IFC, the premise of it was, I pitched a show to Comedy Central a couple of years ago, and I had this idea, and this was before The Walking Dead, before Zombieland, before all of that. And I said, what if you took the cast of Seinfeld and you put it in the world of Dawn of the Dead, because there wasn't The Walking Dead yet as a reference. And there's a zombie apocalypse going on, but it's totally in the background. And you just have these stories about these people living in an apartment building that happens to be surrounded by fencing because you can't have the zombies get in. And the pilot story was the guy and his friend are foraging for food, and he bumps into his old girlfriend. And he's like, oh my God, you survived the plague. I survived the plague. She's like, I know. I hope you don't think that means that we're going to, he's like, no, 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 no. And then he gets angry, and the whole thing is about like, he's really pissed off. And then he's like, well, you got to tell her or this is going to haunt you. So then he goes to tell her and she thinks he's stalking him. And the whole, you know, it's a very human story set in the background of a zombie apocalypse. I thought it was a great idea. I was really proud of it. I thought the script was terrific. And the people at Comedy Central at the time were just like, yeah, we don't think horror comedy works. And they sat on it for 2 years. They killed it, and I'm still angry about it. And so I'd been working on some other stuff, and I still wanted to do a hybrid show because I love horror movies. That's my sort of my comfort food. It's what I grew up watching. I love creature features and all that. That's my jam. So I really wanted to do, but I can't do them straight. They have to be funny for me to, you know, like An American Werewolf in London is one of my favorite movies. Like, that to me is a perfect movie because it's really scary. It's really funny. It's funny in a great way. It works right. Everything is terrific. And so I came up with this other idea after a long time. And ideas, they come at their own pace. Sometimes you got to sit down and grind it out. But even if you grind it out, it's not going to come right away. It's going to take its time. What if I just took a horror movie and then put a character in the middle of it that wasn't from the movie? Like, what if I just put the wrong character in a movie? What if on The X-Files, Gillian Anderson was partnered with my dad instead of David Duchovny. But they had to put up with him, and he was that character. And it would change everything. My brothers and I used to joke when we were little that the ending of King Kong, when all the planes are attacking Kong, we used to say, like, if our dad was in one of the planes, he would veer off, check the game, fly over Yankee Stadium, get the score, come back, shoot a little bit, fly over again, update the score, land, get a beer, come back, fight him a little bit. It wasn't that he didn't believe in monsters, he just didn't care. But it came from just putting a character into a story that didn't belong there and bending the story around it.
So Stan's voice is not just...
It's my dad. And most of Stan's funny witticisms, like, I don't crap an apple, they're all my dad's. I remember I was in Toronto in a hotel working, doing stand-up. And they called up and they said, so we're going to pick up the show and you're not going to be the lead because you need a name. Then we got John McGinley to play the lead, but John was a much younger character than was written. It was very different than what was written. And that was the first time, like, I didn't know he was signed to do the show. He didn't, you know, we met, but he didn't read. You know, I didn't know what he was going to do, but I had to change the character for John, sort of like when he showed up, because he's, you know, 20, 30 years younger than the character that was written, and he's a very physical, athletic guy. And I got an idea. I told him to grow a beard, and then we'll work backwards from it.
So you had talked about how some of your real life ends up in these, especially with The Simpsons.
It's the only way. Whatever you write will end. It will end up in there. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing Life of Brian when I was like 14 years old, 15 years old, and when the aliens came down, my head exploded. Like, I couldn't, because it didn't end the movie. It didn't, but it was so unexpected. The best book about screenwriting I've ever written is called, it's a terrible title, How to Write Screenplays That Sell, which is a gross, shabby title. But it's written by Hal Ackerman, who ran the screenwriting lab at UCLA, and there's a point that he calls point Hosh. I don't know. It's an anagram for something. But point Hosh is when the hero of the movie does something totally contrary to their motivation to achieve their goal. And it's in The Godfather. It's when Michael tells his fiance's father, I'm really Michael Corleone. I'm here because I killed a guy. And he reveals his secret. And it's in There's Something About Mary. Like, it's you can track it in all of these movies. And, you know, when you get stuck, it's like, well, what if he did the opposite of what he's supposed to do? And I love those big surprises in a screenplay.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. All segments were recorded live at the Moon Tower Comedy Festival in Austin, Texas. Special thanks to Chief Executive Officer Jim Ritz, Festival Director Lisa Brass, Talent Producer Colleen McGar, Festival Manager Maggie Hoffman, and Programming Associate Katie Turner. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Sonia McCarter, and Maya Perez. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Audio capture by Travis Kennedy. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from The Sound Lab, Inc., Travis Kennedy, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October.
PRI, Public Radio International.